You're listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KZYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs, and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both places. You can call us here a little later on in the program at the studio at 707-895-2448, or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. My guest on this program is best-selling author Ulrich Boser, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. Before the center, he was a contributing editor for U.S. News and World Report. His work has appeared in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. His recent book is Learn Better, Mastering the Skills for Success in Life, Business, and School, or How to Become an Expert in Just About Anything, in which he shows that how we learn can matter just as much as what we learn. Ulrich Boser, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you. So this book, as I mentioned, focuses on how we learn. Most of us probably think that if we want to learn something, we just, sort of do it, you know, by reading, practicing something, memorizing something as best we can. But there really is a science of learning. There really are new insights into how we might learn better. Would you please introduce us to your project in this book?
Sure. The book argues that for a long time we thought how to learn or learning to learn was really a matter of intelligence, right? Raw cognitive horsepower. And that's really what IQ tests are supposed to measure, right? Our ability to solve problems, to gain knowledge and skills. But recently we've found that there are ways to learn better. And it turns out that learning itself is a process, an approach, a methodology, and there are far more effective ways to gain expertise. What's more, a lot of the conventional wisdom on learning is wrong. So a lot of people believe in learning styles. Turns out that there's no evidence for them. A lot of people use highlighters or will reread, even though there's little evidence for that as well. And that's really the argument of this book, you know, that we can take a lot of findings from the research that's been buried in academic studies and use it in our lives both to acquire expertise, but really to, engage the world in a more meaningful way.
In the introduction, one of the examples you used I thought was kind of striking, starts to begin to illustrate this. That's the experiment with the high school girls and learning darts. Could you just kind of share that anecdote?
Yeah, at a very high level, most people, and you alluded to this at the top of the show, right? If you say, oh, you should learn something, they'll just jump right in. And, you know, that turns out to be a pretty ineffective way to gain expertise. And a number of years ago, some researchers really sort of tried to show this. They taught some darts to some young women in a private school in New York City. And, you know, they told some of them just to give it, you know, wing it. They told some of them just to look at the targets. And some of them, they had them just reflect a little bit more on their practice, gave them some instructional feedback. And also told them, you know, you should at the beginning really focus on the method in which you're learning this and then later kind of focus on the target. And it was just so clear from the study that the women who, young women who really kind of focused, deliberated on their learning, kind of took some of the principles of learning to learn, scored so much better. And, you know, when I went to go visit the researcher who conducted this study, you know, she still had the darts today and she was just, you know, underscoring, you know, what she saw is this really incredible study. And, you know, the study didn't make a lot of attention at the time, though there has been a lot of work done by Barry Zimmerman, who's one of the researchers on that study, showing how, you know, when people focus on, you know, how they learn, they can ultimately gain skills much faster and much more richly, right? They can really use their knowledge in new ways.
You divide the book up into what I might call six discernments about learning. And the first one, I think, is very important. I don't know if we're going to be able to talk about all of them in this short radio broadcast, but the idea that learning really requires some sense of value. It's got to be valuable to the person who's undertaking that learning or undertaking trying to develop a skill. They've got to have a sense of its value. And so I'd like you to talk about that, and particularly what's interesting to me is this idea of creating value. I encountered a lot in my teaching that people treat value like it's just something innate or inherent, like I either value something or I don't. But you seem to have a much more dynamic, active view of it.
Yeah, I find it really fascinating, right? I mean, ultimately what we're talking about is motivation, right? Why do people care about things? And often in education, really the world at large, we think, oh, well, you know, if we'll make this relevant by just, you know, maybe mentioning something in the news or something that seems to seem interesting, right? And then occasionally we'll see people who are like teaching statistics, right? And they'll be like, oh, well, we'll teach the whole class using baseball. And that's really going to just, you know, send so many college kids to take that class. And, you know, what's interesting to me is ultimately what the research has shown here is that people find value, people find motivation when they find their own form of motivation. So, you know, rather than kind of sprinkling lessons or conversations or even speeches with, you know, some pop culture references, people are much better off sort of, you know, reaching out to the audience, reaching out to that individual student and seeing how they find value in the material. In other words, value is really something that goes, it's a one-way street, you know, from the individual to the material. And, you know, there's so many ways of thinking about this. You know, I, like many of us, get these emails from our HR department that are like, you know, you should really care about your retirement and care about, you know, your you know, what your 401k looks like. And like many people, I just, you know, delete them. And, you know, what the research says on this is, you know, they'd be much better off having me sit down for a moment and, you know, writing about what I want to do in retirement. You know, that would be me finding value in that specifically. And researchers like Chris Hullman at UVA have found this in all sorts of ways, really encouraging people to find their own sense of value, whether it's statistics or nursing or knitting, is a great way to spark motivation. And when we think about learning more broadly, the fact is it's just very hard to learn something or teach someone something unless they're motivated to learn it, right? If you don't care, you don't learn. And, you know, while that might seem obvious, it doesn't seem to be so in a lot of schools, right, where we don't do enough to make sure that students can see why this material is relevant to them.
So that has, I think, two implications in a couple of things you talk about. One, you've just mentioned schooling, and I'd like to expand on that. What does the research say about how teachers can more effectively engage students so that they do find their own meaning? It certainly seems to me that the old Prussian model of lecture doesn't work to do that at all. But then another area might be interesting to explore just a little bit is how it plays out in terms of parents and working with their own children and working with their children to allow them to find their own meaning.
Yeah, I think, you know, what's very clear is that it is really a one-way street. So telling someone that something is meaningful is just not enough. So what we've seeing can make a difference is really just giving students the amount of time to say, okay, you're going to learn statistics. You know, why will this statistics help you in your own life? And so some students who are excited about baseball will say, oh, this is going to help me understand the box scores. Some students who really could care less about baseball will say, oh, you know, I know that when I grow up and, you know, want to become a DJ, you know, I'm going to have to think about how songs play. I want to compare how popular songs might be. And then a third student, you know, who wants to grow up to, you know, to grow in politics is going to think about, oh, okay, why do I need statistics to think about polls and that sort of thing? So, you know, it's really allowing people to find their own way, their own path to a topic. The other thing that's really important about finding value or finding meaning is, you know, this is why we learn, right? We talk about, you know, sense making or why people need to engage. And, you know, we often think that our brains are like computers, right? That there's just sort of, you know, some information out there and we got to stuff it in there. But that's not really how our brain works. And so we need to make sense of things. One way to understand this, Stuart, can I put you on the spot for a second and ask a question? You know, what is the capital of Australia?
That's in the book, and I don't even remember it.
That's great. So a researcher asked me the same, you know, question, and I was so embarrassed. I was guessing like Sydney, Melbourne, The answer is Canberra. And, you know, researchers have done this with a lot of questions, like who's featured in the Immaculate Conception. And the bottom line here is that, you know, when you make an error, right, when you guess wrongly like I did, you end up actually learning a lot more. And I think it really underscores this idea that, you know, learning is a matter of making sense of something. And the more that you make errors, the more you tend to make sense of things. And, you know, in the study that looks at this hyper-correction effect, the more confident you are in your answer, right? If you're really convinced that the capital of Australia is Melbourne, the more you're going to remember when you're wrong. And I think, you know, it allows us to think about this idea that we're really trying to make connections, understand, and not really have this, you know, rote memory. We want to really engage, and that's what's going to allow us to solve problems. It's really a matter of finding meaning then.
Right. Another part of this is, along with people finding their own connection to it, their own relationship to the meaning, is some of the things that you talk about, that meaning and making that connection is a whole mind-body kind of thing. It's not just a mental thing. It's the metaphor of the brain as a computer really doesn't work. You prefer a different metaphor that has a more connected idea. So would you talk about that a little bit? I like the example in the book of the whole mental abacus idea.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, right? I mean, I think we're so used to thinking that, you know, thoughts occur in our brain, and that, you know, rational thinking is kind of cool and independent of our bodies, but that's not the way it really works. I mean, you know, so I'm sitting here in an office space, and if I were to give the finger to my computer, and then a researcher brought in the exact same computer, and I just waved at that computer, and then you would test me afterwards, I would have kinder thoughts. I would think more highly of the second computer that I waved at, as opposed to the first computer that I gave the finger at. And, you know, we've seen all sorts of research like this, but basically what's happening is my hand is doing the thinking, right? In this example where I give the finger, my thoughts are being influenced by my body. And it's a weird thing when you start to think about it, right? Because we're just so not familiar with this idea that our hands can think. But, you know, as we talk, we gesture. It helps us bring thoughts to mind. And there are all sorts of examples like this where, you know, people will feel a certain way and will influence their thinking. We can use this to learn better. One thing that's important from this idea of the mind-body connection is it helps us understand that if we're feeling stressed or if we're feeling anxious, it's hard to learn, right? Our body is just focused on trying to keep us safe. There are also ways where you can, you know, if you're giving an important speech, you can offload thoughts to your hand. So if you want to remember at the end that you should thank the host, you know, try and associate that with a certain flip of your wrist or, a flick of your finger, and that will help bring that to mind. And, you know, we also just need to understand that we need this time to relax and to allow us to, engage material in more meaningful ways by being deliberate, by being reflective, to allow information really to sink in.
Could you explicate the mental abacus idea? Because I think it connects into this, and it's an interesting way to think about learning math. And then after you talk about that a little bit, I'd like you to make the connection to education, how we've learned a lot of this. There's been a lot of insight into how to better learn, and yet it's not making its way into the educational system.
Yeah, so at a very high level, there's abacus. It's an ancient device. Dates back thousands of years, predate the alphabet, predates glass, and it is what a lot of people, you know, might imagine it to be, kind of beads and a few rows. And over the years, there's been a certain type of abacus that is now widely used in Japan and a lot in Asia that's really evolved to work with the way that our minds work. And so the abacus really, the way people use it, it works well with our mind because it's very easy to become overwhelmed with data, and there are just a few beads on it. And, you know, we can talk about this a lot. I ended up taking abacus lessons with my own kids and really becoming fascinated with this tool because it helps us understand how we learn. But one key, really central lesson to it is that when people use the abacus, and sometimes they might not have a physical abacus in front of them, they will imagine it in their minds and then use their hands to support their thinking. And what is remarkable about this is that I've seen people add, you know, 5-6-digit numbers, right? So 307,052 plus 600,058, five of those in their heads in less than a second, right? In less than the amount of time that I am speaking about this. And it's because they're able to use their hands to help them envision, basically to help them do the math. And it's, you know, just another example of the ways in which our body physically helps us think. You know, I mentioned just a moment ago, Stuart, that, you know, our working memory is short and it's easy for us to get overloaded. And I'm going to give an example right now, and that is I forgot the second part of your question because I was thinking about answering the first part.
No problem. I wanted you to get into talking about how there really are some scientifically based insights into how to learn better. And an example of that with learning math. Math continues to be a very difficult thing for a lot of people, but there are ways that have been found to ease that process, make people more adept at math. There's cultural differences, and we can see it in scores across the country and across the world and that kind of thing. But then also bring in this other thing, the Gates Foundation idea of the measures for effective teaching, and that's got some real insights into how to more effectively educate people. And yet it's so tough to get it into the educational system, these things that really do make a difference and could make a difference, and yet they're not adopted.
Yeah, so I'd love to talk about this. I think, you know, for listeners out there, one recommendation that I have that really works and works whether you're trying to get better at chemistry or Russian history, and that is testing yourself. The more that you quiz yourself, and this can be just a matter of memory, right? The more that you bring something to mind is very effective, but also just free recall. There's really a tremendous body of research that shows that, you know, if you read something and restudy it or make a concept map, it's nowhere nearly as effective as testing yourself, as putting away the material and really asking yourself questions of like, what did I learn? What connections does it have? So really quizzing yourself, testing yourself. In the book, I have quizzes. As we saw early in the show, I'm not afraid to ask you some questions as well, whether it's the, you know, capital of Australia or not. But quizzing yourself is really so crucial. And, you know, I think that there's a time and a place for lecture-style classes, but to imagine to lecture for 2 hours without, you know, quickly quizzing students is really not an effective way to learn. And, you know, what's interesting about, you know, some of this is that it's also just hard for it to be rolled out. You know, the reason that quizzing works so much is that it really encourages us to make sense of material. It really encourages a more active form of learning. And, you know, I recently was preparing for a speech, and I was reading my notes, and I could just even tell that I kept rereading my notes. And then it dawned on me that this was sort of the advice that I'm offering to other people. You know, don't just reread material, be active. And so I put away my notes and engage in it. And what it underscores to me is, you know, we do some of these practices like rereading because they comfort us, but they don't actually help us learn, you know, more effectively. So I could give other examples and eager to do so, but, you know, testing yourself is really an incredibly powerful way that cuts across so many different areas. And yet, you know, I walk into schools all the time and I see people using highlighters. Not only that, they use multicolored highlighters. You know, not a lot of research behind highlighters, but testing yourself, if I've not said it, you know, is so much more effective.
Right. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is Ulrich Boser, author of Learn Better, Mastering the Skills for Success in Life, Business, and School, or How to Become an Expert in Just About Anything. You can find out more on the web at considerthis.us or at kzyx.org. Let's get into this memory aspect of things, because that's another part of our traditional thinking of learning, is that it's a matter of just memorizing things. And all of that kind of thinking about how to learn and what to learn and learning information, learning content, there's really a big shift. We've offloaded a lot of that content in this modern age, and we've also learned an awful lot about both short-term and long-term memory. So that's two topics maybe if you could talk about.
So, you know, memory is a funny thing. You know, one thing that we should keep in mind about memory, and this is an odd thing, is that we don't actually really forget anything. So, you know, how do we know this? Researchers have shown that if I were to go to you, Stuart, and say, hey, you know, do you recall your high school locker number? I suspect I know what your answer to that is going to be. Do you think you can remember your high school locker number?
No, I can't.
Okay. But if I show you, you know, four codes, much more than chance would suggest, you're actually able to guess what the right one is. And so from evidence like this and other research that we've seen, you know, we know that people don't really fully forget everything. What really, and I'm going to be clear here that this is a good thing, right? Like, you want to remember where you left your keys today. You don't want to remember where you left your keys yesterday, right? So what's key here, though, is retrieving stuff from memory is what keeps it kind of top at mind because, and this is thankfully, you don't continue to recall your high school locker number. Basically, your brain has made a little more space for other important information, like, you know, your locker number today or, you know, where you parked your car this afternoon. And so what's key to understand about memory, we don't really forget, but retrieving is really, really important. So the more that we pull something out of memory, the more it stays top of mind. And then the other side of that is, you know, we do forget, right? Things sort of slip, and they slip at a very regular rate. And so we have to make sure that we revisit periodically, or we won't have that information really when we need it.
Yeah, I found that very interesting in terms of education too, this idea that the spacing, the timing of it, and repeating it over a period of time is really important to moving things from short-term memory to long-term memory.
Yeah, so there was a study, my favorite study of this, you know, done by Nate Cornell. He was walking around the UCLA campus and noticed that, you know, some students had these huge, thick flashcards when they were studying, and some other students just had small ones. And he thought, oh, you know, maybe it would make a difference. So he did a study, and so just imagine, you know, maybe tomorrow you're going to fly down to Mexico. You want to improve your Spanish. You have a choice. Do you want to study one very large stack of 100 Spanish cards, or do you want to have four stacks of 25? But once you've done a stack, you can't revisit that stack. What would you choose?
Well, I've read the book, so I know the answer.
Oh, well, that's good. I think most people, what we've seen in these types of studies, would choose the smaller stacks. It just seems a little bit easier. But for many students, they learn about 30% more if they have the big stack because it's just a way for them to space out their learning. In other words, you have that first word you come across, I don't know, abuelita, and you're like, oh, you know, you learn that it's grandmother. And then you go through a number of words, and then you have to come across it again. And, you know, it's a way for us to spread out our learning, space out our learning. And in some fields where memory is really important, like foreign languages, that's really, really important.
So let's move into another area. It's been, I think, a common idea in thinking. I come from the philosophy tradition, so I know some of its roots back there. But the difference between and the distinction between thinking and feeling, or thinking and emotions, and for a long time there's been an emphasis on kind of suppressing the emotions or getting the emotions out of the way and just doing kind of the rational thing. But the more recent research really shows a strong connection between the two.
Yeah, it's weird, right? You know, emotions do really kind of underscore, or better yet, you know, sit at the center of thought. And when we think about, you know, education, you know, this is what we spoke about a little bit earlier, right? This idea that, you know, we need to feel safe. But there's also something that goes deeper, right? We need to have our emotions kind of attached to thoughts, so that we have kind of a richer level of thinking and understanding. And I think we understand this in some fields. You know, in creativity, people are like, oh, you need to, you know, incubate, and that's why, you know, you have these moments of brilliance, or at least semi-brilliance, you know, in the shower. right, where you're sort of, you know, taking your shower and you finally have an insight. But it's very similar in education. You know, we need time to, you know, to reflect, to deliberate. The research on this is I think, really fascinating. You know, there are studies that show that teachers, as well as, I imagine, you know, radio show hosts, but the studies have really been done on teachers, they need to leave a 3 to 5 second pause after they, you know, explain a big concept to allow students to gain more. So what they were able to show in studies is that teachers who only leave a 1 second pause show lower effects than teachers that leave that 3 to 5 second pause. But people, including myself, you know, during this conversation, you know, can totally ignore this advice, right? Because, you know, we're excited to, you know, be on the radio, talk to smart folks like you. We want to share the information and are excited. But when you look at really great public speakers, someone like Barack Obama, you know, they speak incredibly slowly. And one of the reasons for this is that it allows people the time to deliberate, allows people the time to have their emotions under support and attach themselves to their thinking.
In the book, you talk about this. Certainly, it seems to me emotion can connect back to what we were talking about earlier, that there's got to be an emotional component to finding value in things, finding meaning in things. But in the book, you also talk about people's, something maybe a little broader, people's sense of their own efficacy. You say psychologists call it self-efficacy. And I have to admit, too, and I'd like you to distinguish, when I was reading that part of the book, it reminded me a little bit of some of the stuff from Norman Vincent Peale. I'm old enough to remember that, and The Power of Positive Thinking, and some of that has been debunked. So maybe you're not familiar with that, but if you could distinguish that difference.
Yeah, I'm going to admit that I'm less familiar with that line of work, but you know, the self-efficacy work has been incredibly robust. Albert Bandura was at Stanford, was the person who really pioneered it. And, you know, it's different than just sort of like confidence, right, which is, or even self-confidence. Really, the idea is, you know, do you feel like you can achieve something, you can accomplish that goal? And, you know, not surprisingly, it's a really key aspect to learning. They've shown the value of self-efficacy in all sorts of fields, right? So it turns out to be very key in dieting. If you feel like you cannot gain, not lose weight, you know, not surprisingly, you're not going to put a lot of effort into losing weight. You know, and I think this gets at a bigger issue here, is that learning, effective learning, is hard, right? It involves struggle. And I think often we tell people, oh, learning is going to be fun, and it can be fun, certainly those moments of, you know, insight, but a lot of it is difficult. And so we need to have a sense that we are actually going to accomplish, that we are, in fact, going to learn, and that is a really crucial aspect of motivation, and then ultimately gaining some sense of expertise.
I'm going to go ahead and open up the phone lines a little early here. See, I had one kind of call come in and go away, but if you've got some questions for Ulrich Boser on learning to learn and learning better, please give us a call at 707-895-2448, and we'll take your calls. And you can also send us an email at dj@kzyx.org. You just mentioned the idea of struggle. Learning can sometimes be hard. And something that goes along with that, and you talk about in the book, is that learning involves making mistakes. Learning involves errors, and we have very little tolerance for that in our times.
Yeah, I mean, you know, mistakes are awkward, they're embarrassing, and, you know, we don't want to do them, right? This is why I think, you know, people are so hesitant to give, you know, feedback. You know, they don't want to embarrass other people, and yet, you know, mistakes are so crucial to learning. One, as we, you know, talked about earlier, when we make errors, we often sort of learn more, right? By making the error, we can gain deeper insights. And then also, you know, it's just part of this idea. There is a psychologist at UCLA who has done some smart work on this, arguing that there is something called desirable difficulties. In other words, that learning gets better when it's more difficult. And, you know, making mistakes like leaving your phone on during a phone interview, you know, you have that moment of embarrassment that the phone rang. And so, you know, you'll be far more likely then in the future to double check to make sure your phone is off before you get on an interview.
Right. And it ties back into the emotional aspect. Embarrassment certainly seems to be part of that. And being embarrassed and having that overwhelm you and feelings of anxiety about it are going to get in the way of learning.
Yeah, I had this experience, you know, as part of the book. I really like to play basketball, middle age in my 40s. And I decided to take some basketball lessons. And, you know, I've been writing about education for the past 20 years on and off, and I was amazed at one, you know, how much improvement I saw just by taking a few lessons, right? Within, you know, three lessons with this guy, and he was an accomplished basketball player himself, had played with the Globetrotters organization for a long time. You know, I got better, but I'm going to admit that I was really embarrassed about it, right? I didn't want to tell the other people I played basketball with. When I showed up to my lessons, you know, most of the other, you know, of his clients were kids my kids' age, right? These were like 7 and 8 year old boys and girls, and I would sort of, you know, try and pretend a little bit like I was a, you know, parent, really sort of shepherding my own kid, because I was embarrassed, right? A 40-something year old should maybe take golf lessons, maybe tennis, but certainly not basketball. But it showed you know, some really strong impact for me. And, you know, I'm be clear, I'm playing basketball for fun and for exercise. You know, any aspirations for the NBA have long left me. But, you know, exposing myself and, you know, allowing some sort of personal liabilities, if you will, really helped me improve my game.
It reminds me of another point in the book you make, that humility is really important here to learning. And that reminded me when I was reading it of, since I'm a philosopher, Socrates, you know, he was, by the oracle, he was told that he was wise because he knew that he didn't know and everybody else thought they knew. And so being willing to learn, be open to learning something new, being humble about what you know, knowing what you know and what you don't know, that's an important aspect of this as well.
Yeah, I think, you know, philosophy is great in this regard. There's this idea I'm sure you're familiar with, but I don't feel like enough people are, you know, aware of it, but this idea of thinking about thinking, being metacognitive. And thinking about thinking includes a couple of aspects. One is planning, right? So are you setting goals for yourself? And then other is just sort of reflecting and asking yourself, you know, do I really know this? And, you know, what's important is that we're often overconfident. And this humility, as you pointed out, is really important because we often think that we know a lot more than we do. Now, on one side, behavioral economics has really mined this, and some wonderful studies, embarrassing to all of us, but, you know, most people believe that they're above average when it comes to driving. Most people believe that they're above average when it comes to looks. Most people believe that they're above average when it comes to working hard at work, but we can't all be above average, right? So there are a lot of people out there who are, you know, overconfident, and we tend to be very overconfident about things that are familiar to us. So, you know, there's some wonderful studies that have shown people love to say they know how a toilet works, right? Because we all spend a lot of time on the toilet. But when you really sort of look into it, people are actually unable to really explain, you know, how a toilet works. And so we're all overconfident. Sometimes it's a really good thing. People wouldn't give, you know, interviews if they weren't to some degree overconfident. But when it comes to learning, you know, it can be a bad thing, right? We think that we know stuff that we don't know. We think that we have stuff in our memory or that it's easily retrievable when it's not. And this really impedes us. And, you know, it also helps us understand why there are so many students out there who are like, I don't know why I failed the test. You failed the test because you didn't know. You were overconfident. And, you know, this is really an important thing. And we can use this, you know, to our advantage. And it helps us understand why, you know, explaining something to someone else is a great way to learn. You know, we'll very quickly realize if we don't really know what we're talking about.
Right. I really learn. I tell you, this is something I share with my students often. I really started to learn philosophy, not in graduate school. I started to learn philosophy when I had to teach it, when I had to actually explain some of the ideas and concepts to other people. It integrated in a much more deep, profound, meaningful way.
Yeah, right. I mean, so on one side, teaching other people is sort of like quizzing, right? You have to do the explaining. But then there is an added aspect, right, where you have to start thinking about how other people are thinking about that topic. And so you want to address their, you know, misconceptions. And then when, certainly we've all had the experience, you know, whether we're professional educators or not, right, where you're explaining something to someone and it's very clear on their face that they don't entirely know what you're talking about.
Right.
You know, and I'll be honest, that's also what makes it fun to talk to people about this work, because I know that I'm gaining when people are asking questions, when I'm forced to explain some of the ideas, that, you know, it's helping me make these connections and understand the topic of learning a little bit better. And it seems like it was similar to you for philosophy.
Yeah. Got a call coming in, so I'm going to go ahead and take it. Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Phil.
Phil, go ahead.
Hi. Who am I? Can I talk now?
Yep, you're on the air with Ulrich Boser. Yep.
Yeah. A few years ago, I learned that I was dyslexic. I'm 84 at this time. And I also was learned that I'm ADD, ADHD, and all that alphabet stuff, too. And so throughout my life, like, learning was very, very difficult for me, and I didn't know it. I didn't know that I had something wrong with my brain. I thought that, you know, I was just stupid, you know. And so learning this gave me a big boost, you know, and, you know, I felt much better about myself. And I just want to know if you have anything to say about this, and I'll hang up, you know, and so you can talk.
Thanks, Phil. Appreciate it.
Right. Bye.
So, all right.
I think the caller brings up, you know, a good question, and that is, you know, for some people learning is a struggle, and, you know, some people do have you know, disabilities, whether it's ADHD or learning disabilities. You know, I had some of these struggles myself. I repeated kindergarten. I spent some time in special education. Also had a diagnosis of a learning disability when I was younger, and for me, what it really sparked was an interest in this topic, and, you know, it's what has brought me back to thinking about, you know, how can we scale this issue. So what ends up being important for people with learning disabilities and ADHD, I mean, these are very specific types of cognitive struggles, and so what's going to help someone with dyslexia is going to be different. But, you know, I think we have to keep in mind that, you know, learning is difficult for all of us, whether we have these disabilities or not, and often the more difficult that we make learning, the better off we are in the end, right? We retain that information and often understand a lot more.
I'd like to get into, while we're waiting for some more calls, again, if you'd like to call and talk about learning better, the phone number is 707-895-2448. My guest is Ulrich Boser. Is some of the work that Carol Dweck down at Stanford has done, and this idea, it goes back to a little bit what we've been talking about. She distinguishes between naturers and nurturers, people who think that an ability to learn is a matter of something innate, natural, like intelligence, or it's more something that you can develop, you can nurture. And I particularly would like you to get into, she's found some very specific kinds of disciplined ways to improve that. One is that language and how we speak to students or our children specifically really makes a difference. And how we react to them makes a big difference. So there's really some discipline that needs to be brought to bear, I think, in this.
Yeah, so this fundamental idea that I thought you described well, and just to unpack it a little bit more, is that, you know, some people believe that they have fixed abilities. So they are good at math or they are bad at math, they are good at singing or they are bad at singing. And the issue is that once you come across this struggle, if you're someone who are like, I am, you know, good at math, if you have this kind of what she calls a fixed mindset, when you come across things that are difficult for you, it kind of suggests that maybe you're bad at math. And so the opposite of that is people who have a little bit more flexible thinking, right? People who would think, oh, well, if I practice, even though it might be hard now, you know, I'll be able to gain this. In all sorts of fields will do a lot better. They're much more willing to expose themselves to errors. They're much more willing to put in the hard work. You know, Carol's work has been around for a while, and I think it's quite fascinating. Some of the more recent research about what I think is really interesting, especially for parents, is, you know, one question is, you know, how do parents convey this, and language makes a big difference, right? If you're always praising your kid for being smart, it's a weak practice. It encourages students to have this fixed mindset to think, oh, if they can't do something, it's because they don't lack smarts. But even more important than that, Carol Dweck has found in her own work that parents really need to model this behavior, right? That if they come home from work and they've failed at something, you know, telling the students, this is a learning opportunity for me, that parents don't say, oh, I can't do that just because I'm not smart. And another way of thinking about this is that kids are, you know, themselves, you know, much more keenly aware of the world around them than we think. In other words, you know, they can tell when their parents are just saying something without a real belief.
Got another call. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Oh, hi, my name's Bob. Earlier, your guest was talking about thinking with your fingers, and it really struck a chord because my parents started me learning music when I was 5 years old. Mm-hmm. And whenever I encounter a problem or a subject, I just instinctively think of it in musical terms, and I think with my fingers. It just made a whole lot of sense to me about that. And I'm sure that, you know, when somebody like Eric Clapton is up on stage, they're not thinking in their brain with the notes they're going to play. Their fingers have all the information. Just, you know, it's a brilliant way to frame that whole idea. Also, I'm reading a book called Intelligence in the Flesh by Guy Claxton, I think it is. And I'm wondering if your guest is familiar with that author and how the book, ideas in that book compare with what's in this book, Learn Better, that I haven't had a chance to read yet.
Bob, thanks. Ulrich, get the questions?
Yeah, so, you know, one is just the idea that, you know, we can think with our fingers. There's, you know, wonderful examples like this. The caller mentioned musicians, and I'm going to take some more, you know, prosaic examples, right? But there are studies that show if you trace something like an architectural drawing with your finger, you know, that's actually going to help you learn in that way. You know, there's a lot of, you know, material around, you know, how our body is feeling, right? That, again, supports our ability to think. You know, I think, you know, there's all sorts of ways that we can, you know, engage in this and even acting something out, right? So if you're reading a bit of literature and you act it out, right, that's another way to involve your body with that type of thinking. The caller also mentioned Guy Claxton. I've read an earlier book of his, but I wasn't familiar with the, you know, more recent work. You know, where I know his work from is really encouraging. You know, how can we think more deeply about topics? You know, in this world where we can get facts online so quickly, you know, facts still remain very important, but we want to engage in, you know, what researchers often call kind of higher order thinking. In other words, we want to be able to learn stuff so we can apply it in new ways. And I've always recognized him for underscoring how important that idea is.
Yeah, and that gets us into another one of these discernments in the book. One of these topic areas is about higher order thinking. I'm just going to quote something from the book. The underpinnings of the ability to do higher order thinking really comes down to reasoning about relationships.
Yeah, I mean, it's a weird thing. I mean, I think, you know, what is thought, you know, as a philosopher, I'm sure you've engaged with this. And, you know, increasingly there's consensus that thought is ultimately thinking about systems, thinking about analogies. And when we think about experts, what they're able to do really is think in analogical ways. So my favorite example of this, and this might be familiar to your listeners, there was the Car Talk show. It was very popular for a long time, but it was two goofy guys who would answer car questions on the radio. And, you know, it was a funny show, largely because they would make a lot of puns and bad jokes. But at the core of it, I mean, they were incredible car experts. And if you know, deliberate on the show for a moment, you know, what would happen is that someone would call in and be like, oh, you know, I have a Buick and it has this white smoke. And the guys, click and clack, would figure out what the car problem was, even though they didn't know the person who called in. They had never seen the car before. And so how did they do it? They used an analogy, right? They thought about other Buicks they had worked on. They had thought about other cars that had produced white smoke, you know, other noises, and used that to solve the problem. And we can use that idea, right, this idea of analogical thinking to gain expertise in better ways. Because ultimately, right, we learn because we want to be able to apply that learning in new ways. And when people talk about rote learning, right, it's basically that you only know the procedure. You don't really know how to do it. And even when it comes down to something like changing a car, right, changing a tire on a car, you don't want to only be able to learn how to change a tire on your car. You want to be able to make sure that if your friend has a flat, you can change a tire on their car or future cars. And so what does that mean? It means that you need to know about the principles. You need to know about the relationships. You need to know about the systems itself, even if you don't want to become an expert tire changer.
Another call coming in. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
My name is Cecina.
Hi, Cecina. Go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering if your guest had read Maria Montessori, because, you know, over 100 years ago, Maria Montessori said, follow the child. So, you know, you would, of course, emotionally, physically, intellectually, you're following that child and all that child, materials and methods that we know.
You're breaking up just a little bit. I think we got the gist of it.
All right. And so I want to say that you know, our teacher training programs in America are fantastic. People from all over the world come here to learn and take it back to their countries. But our national education programs do not? They do not follow our teachers.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
They make our teachers do things they want them to do, like Gates and DeVos.
Okay. Thanks, Cecina. We'll get Ulrich's response.
So Maria Montessori created, after a lot of practice and a lot of trying, this Montessori method. You know, I'm not familiar with all the ins and outs of it, but at a very high level, it really encourages, as the caller said, you know, following the child, allow children to experiment, hands-on learning. And what I think is important to keep in mind about hands-on learning or project-based learning, there's a lot of different ways people have talked about this idea, is that it really depends on where it comes in the education process, right? So, you know, if you wanted to learn how to ride a bike, for instance, you've never ridden a bike before, and I just said, you know, give it your best shot, I think that you'd have a lot of trouble riding a bike, or at least you'd have a couple of, you know, skinned knees at the very least, right? That hands-on learning, when it comes too early in the process, can actually hurt your learning. But at the same time, you know, if you have some basic ideas about how to ride a bike, you know what the brakes are, you know, you've practiced a little bit, you know the basic idea of pedaling, it is incredibly important that you have some time to really take the bike for a spin, do it in different environments, make sure that you have a sense of, okay, you know, if it's raining or there are train tracks, you know, how you're going to get around those, how you can come around curves. And so ultimately, I think, you know, we have these debates, you know, is hands-on learning good, is hands-on learning bad? In my mind, the question is, when does it occur? Because what we know for sure is that people need to take knowledge out for a spin, and that's why, you know, maybe teaching philosophy, as it did in your experience, or even, you know, talking on the radio, helps me, you know, grow my expertise, because I have a foundation in the area. But if it comes too early in the process, right, it can make our learning ultimately be a lot more painful than it needs to.
Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Sue.
Hi, Sue, go ahead.
I was wondering what you think about the intent of the Greeks. We study Greek mythology. For example, Athena talked about how she punishes the mortals for thinking that they know more than the gods. Athena punishes the mortals. So I wonder what those lessons can teach us.
Okay. See what
the of the Greeks.
Okay. We'll get Ulrich's response. Thanks.
Yeah, to me is that there's a long effort in education where that if we learn Latin or we learn Greek, or if you're better at chess, that you'll be better at other things, right? So now people have argued, oh, well, if we only all learned Greek, we would be much better philosophers or mathematicians or even coders, right? Because, you know, these things kind of train our mind. And there's really very little evidence that we can transfer from one field to another. And so we should sort of keep in mind, right, that our brain isn't this sort of universal muscle that we can train on different things. We really, to become an expert, whether it's in Greek or coding, we have to really learn that specific topic. And it's just how our brain ultimately works. And I think, you know, on one side, you know, often we're trying to justify the arts and music by saying it increases learning elsewhere. I think that's wrong, but we should still encourage people to learn, you know, arts and music because it makes for well-rounded people. They are enjoyment for their own purpose. But I'd be careful about trying to think about, you know, neurotraining. There are all sorts of examples of this idea of people trying to create an overall general brain muscle, and a lot of research has shown that it's not the case.
Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Sue,
go ahead.
Well, I wasn't talking about the Greek language nor the Latin language. I was talking about the intent that the Greeks might have had for us, for their lessons. The mythology, the Greek mythology, is about lessons that the mortals have to take in relation, and when they do something wrong, they're punished. So I wonder how applicable that is to us. Like the Bible has lessons. They have parables about what you need to do in order to succeed. We have lessons everywhere. What to do in order to succeed and not fail, in order to not suffer. You know, the Buddhists have lessons of people for people of what to do and not to do in order to not suffer.
Okay.
So I wonder what the Greeks' purpose was, because their stories are way beyond my capability of understanding what the purpose of having immortals and mortals, of deities versus the, you know, besides being an interesting story, what would be the purpose of these lessons?
Okay, let's see if Ulrich's got a response. Thanks.
So, Sue, I'm so glad that you called back and clarified. I didn't hear you as well as I would have liked the first time. And if I understand your question now, is sort of, you know, so many religious areas or even areas like Greek, you know, taught in these types of lessons. As the caller pointed out, you know, this is important to the Bible. It's important to Buddhism. And I think what's interesting there, right, is that, you know, these lessons, when they work well, are basically analogies, right? And so they allow us to think about ideas in a richer way. And, you know, earlier was talking about this idea that analogies are really at the core of thought. And, you know, when we look through Greek mythology, we can see that, right? So when we think about, you know, flying too close to the sun, the story of Icarus, right, it allows us to think about and use our own analogies to come across this idea of, you know, people being too proud. And we can think about, oh, okay, you know, why did, you know, Marilyn Monroe marry men who, this was my own Greek teacher, and this was a lesson that he always told us as young men, that beautiful women sometimes want to marry ugly men, which explains why Hephaestus was able in Greek mythology to marry such a beautiful woman. I was always fond of this myself as a young student, right? But it allows us to understand these other ways because we're using then an analogical thought to say, oh, you know, is Hephaestus like Joe DiMaggio, who Marilyn Monroe ultimately married? And I think what we see in these stories, whether, you know, it's Jesus's stories around, you know, turning loaves and fishes into a feast, or stories from Buddhism, which I'm a little bit less familiar with, the idea of these parables, they're, you know, these short stories that allow us big lessons because they allow us to engage in analogical thought.
We're down to the end of the time here, Ulrich, and so I'd like to give you a chance to just give us any final thoughts. I want to express my appreciation for you being on the show. And again, let listeners know that we've been talking to Ulrich Boser. He's the author of Learn Better. That's the short title.
Great. Well, it's, you know, been an honor here. And, you know, it's wonderful to speak with callers who are, you know, so fascinated with this topic. And, you know, I think we've covered a lot of these ways to, in fact, learn better, you know, teaching other people, quizzing yourself, making sure that, you know, learning isn't easy, because that's ultimately what helps us, you know, gain knowledge and expertise in more effective ways.
Once again, thanks, Ulrich. I appreciate you being on the show. The book is Learn Better. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.